Blog Talk Radio. Welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in therapy and research. What do men want? In bed and out. What do women want? And how does this all tie together? And who's getting tied up? These are just a few of the questions I'll be asking sex therapist Dr. Brandy Engler tonight. I promise you, you think you know the answers, and you will find her actual answers unexpected and eye-opening. Dr. Engler is unique in that she opened a sex therapy practice for women, expecting to slowly get some female clients, and she quickly amassed a full list of clients, all men. Brandy Engler, Dr. Engler, and New York Times bestselling biographer David Renson have just published a fascinating book about her sessions and her insights, The Men on My Couch, True Stories of Sex, Love, and Psychotherapy. This is your chance to go inside her sessions to see into the erotic minds of men, and not just pervos or deviants, but regular guys, men we all know. And beyond the men, we also see into the minds of the women having sex with these men, or refusing to, and find out why and what can be done to get them back in bed together. Hello, Brandy.
Hi.
Hi. So thank you for coming on. I love your book, and I didn't mention this in my promos, but David Renson, your co-author, is a very good friend of mine. I didn't want to say that because I have many friends who write books, but this is a fantastic book. I didn't want anyone to think I had the book on because he was my friend, but because of your insights, which are really, really novel and not the typical stuff you hear from sex therapists.
Thank you.
So now, you say that guys tell you exactly what they want. They plop down on your couch and say straight out, I want casual sex. Or I want passion. One guy said, I just like naked women. But it turns out they don't really know what they want after all.
Right. Well, often what I'm finding is they're not necessarily self-reflecting on what do I really want here, you know. And so they'll present with some superficial sort of, you know, I like naked women, or I just like women with big boobs and a small waist. That's it. You know, like it's very simple. But all it takes is for me to ask a few questions, explore a little bit, and all kinds of other stuff kind of comes up to the surface. Very interesting.
And so now you talk about the difference between men and women seeking therapy. You say that women will seek out therapy for anxiety and depression, but they're slow to seek therapy for low libido. They assume that their waning passion is normal.
Right. Something which I find very tragic. A lot of women sort of just assume that's a normal part of the, you know, of monogamy or a long-term relationship, and they sort of just, you know, give into that or comply or possibly go along with duty sex. And so they don't necessarily seek treatment and, you know, say that this is something that I want to change in my life.
Duty sex, that's a really horrible term for a horrible thing.
Yes.
How much of that, do you feel that a lot of women are doing that?
Yes, a lot of the women that come into my office and, you know, talk to me about their sex lives are saying, listen, you know, I'm married or I'm in a relationship that I want to keep, and so I just sort of do it as an obligation to keep him happy, and, you know, they just sort of see it as, you know, maintenance.
And so there's a different sort of thing with men, and you say this is why you got all these calls right away, that with men, when the penis doesn't work, they reach out.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if it's because, you know, their sexuality is so closely associated with their identity, their self-esteem, their masculinity, but they definitely reach out in some way, you know, whether it be for, you know, medication like Viagra, or if they choose to sort of go to a sex worker or a sex service, like looking to sort of fix the issue, or if they come to a sex therapist like myself.
And now, one of the things I found very fascinating in your book, Men on My Couch, which you co-authored with David Renson, was that you say you discovered one constant truth, that sex is rarely just sex. And you talk about needs for power and approval or to master old traumas as some of the reasons people have sex.
That's right. So there's often all kinds of hidden sort of psychological and emotional motivations that people aren't aware of, sort of driving what they're doing. And all sexual expression is communicating something. They're not just sort of fantasies or preferences that kind of come out of a vacuum or out of nowhere, sort of like some people say, well, I just like this. It's just how I am. But if you reflect on it a little bit, you see that sex is like sort of this revelatory of a lot of projection and wishes and fears and, desires for something usually. Often people are searching for some aspect of themselves. I want to feel this. I want to feel powerful, or I want to feel special or superior. I want to feel not anxious. They want to feel something in particular.
And now, one thing that's interesting throughout your book, you talk about, you know, you're very humble in your approach, and you also are looking constantly at your misconceptions. You had just started out as a therapist at the beginning of the book, and you talk about some of the misconceptions you had about men and male sexuality. What were some of them?
I think that I, based on my sort of personal experiences, that I had sort of a very romanticized and idealized sort of way of looking at love and romance. And that I didn't want to look at sort of the harder truths about the way that, you know, men and women can behave sexually, the way that men and women can treat each other. And so I think it was particularly jarring for me when I first starting out as a therapist to really listen to some of the behaviors that they were reporting to me.
One of the things that I liked was that you said it was important to you to avoid the, you know, pejorative and facile portrayal of men as superficial and these morally flawed scoundrels, dogs, pigs, bastards. But you say that as you're doing this, you're very honest throughout this book. You say, oh, that thought crossed my mind. Was that, how did you work that as a therapist and as a woman who is going through actually a tumultuous relationship throughout the time the book takes place?
Right. So we're trained as therapists, like a cornerstone of any training as a psychologist, is that you're non-judgmental, you're neutral, your position is always to explore and not to judge. But, you know, as a human being, as a woman, of course you have your own sort of personal reactions, which, again, we're trained to monitor our own reactions. And so, of course, I held some of the same sort of knee-jerk reactions, like, you know, sort of, oh, like, what a jerk, or like, what a pig. But you can't. You know, and so in my own life, too, I'm dating this man who's sort of a womanizer, and I feel unstable and not totally secure. And then I'm listening to these guys who are doing the same thing in their life. And I realized that I've had an opportunity to understand what really drives that. So I had to move past my own judgments because I'm a psychologist and I can't judge or else I have to refer them out to somebody else. I had to move past my own judgment and really get in there and understand. And because I couldn't just sit there and label people, and I had to really get to the motivation, I feel like I gained all of this sort of new insight, which is why I wanted to write the book, because I was really excited about what I was learning.
Well, let's talk about one of your clients. There was this guy, David. He's this rich, cocky narcissist, rising star in the financial world, handsome. He had a girlfriend who modeled professionally, a Tribeca apartment, came right in, remarked on your looks, and I can say this because I've met you at a party, you're hot. You know, and that's what he said. He said, wow, Doc, you're pretty attractive. I think I'm going to like talking to you. You know, I mean, how does that sex therapy session, the start of that, work for you, and how do you work that?
What I do is as soon as they do that, right away, I mirror it back to them. So I basically respond by saying something along the lines of, you know, okay, you're coming into me to a therapist for help, but what you're actually doing right now is sexualizing me. Let's talk about your need to do that. So just throw it right back on them immediately.
And so this guy's question was, I don't think I even know what love is. And he wanted you to tell him, you know, and you're saying you're supposed to be non-judgmental. So what do you do when the guy says that?
Let's explore, you know, what that means to you and what it is that you're actually looking for. But I really appreciated that he asked that question because it kind of showed that, you know, even though he was an attractive guy, he was perfectly capable of carrying on this lifestyle of, you know, just like conquesting woman after woman. But that actually that there was something missing there, that he actually did want, he was interested in monogamy and he was interested in love. He just wasn't sure if it was possible.
And so you mentioned, I was going to say, just to give people a little background, he was this guy, he had this gorgeous girlfriend, but he would go out and cheat on her and really collect women's numbers, really more to collect them, you said, than really to connect with them.
Yes. It wasn't even important to him to have sex, even though he would sometimes have sex with those women. Most of the time he did not. The primary thing he was looking for was just knowing that a woman would say yes. If that's what he wanted. So he primarily just wanted to sort of like, you know, get the validation that, yeah, she wants me. She gave me her phone number. That's what that meant to him.
And this fascinating thing he said he would tell you that he'd imagine a life with each of them. And he, you know, that was fitting with his wanting to settle down and get married.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. And you actually turned the tables on him, you know, and, you know, you talked about how his womanizing was more important, you know, his competition with other men. And you said, what if a woman was only feigning interest in you, and he got kind of deflated?
It was interesting what a strong reaction that he had to that. It showed his attachment to the idea that people must want me in order for me to be valuable, and I have to keep hearing that over and over and over again. And if that idea is even questioned, then there's this deflation. And by him having a deflation like that showed me that the sense of self-esteem he had wasn't real. It wasn't built on a solid foundation, if I could sort of, you know, pop the bubble that just by flicking it, you know? And
right.
So classically, with anyone who's sort of narcissistic, their ego sort of swings way up and it's very inflated, and then it will kind of come crashing down and then go way back up again, and it's not necessarily steady.
So this guy, he really, being a narcissist, then lacked vulnerability.
Yes, yes. And so a lot of these guys, you know, they don't grow out of it if they happen to also be, like, attractive and wealthy like this guy was. He can sort of keep the illusion going on for quite a long time. He's getting a lot of reinforcement for it. So there's no reason for him to ever pause and say, well, why am I doing this? You know, what's happening inside of me that I need to do this?
So, in other words, a poor narcissist is going to get kicked in the teeth at some point. He's going to get uncued at 28 or 35, and he's going to have to realize that what he really wants is not just to collect phone numbers. And so how do you help a guy like this?
What I do is I start to help them to build more awareness of what it is that's truly driving him. And so by asking him a bunch of questions, we kind of just got down to, you know, what was driving it. He had this, you know, there's a sort of a long story to why he felt like, you know, he needed to be competitive with men and that he needed to demonstrate his sort of prowess in order to be, you know, masculine and to be worthy, while all the while feeling like he was never actually being himself. And so for him, it ended up being this exploration of, like, finding himself in a way. And he ended up going in a completely different direction from Wall Street, you know, toward the end after about a year of therapy.
And so is there a way people who don't have sex therapists, that they can, if they are these types that collect women, you know, that are these womanizers, is there a way that they can grow out of that themselves, or do you have to have a professional person asking you questions?
Even with a professional person, it's notoriously difficult to work with this, but I think that the door in is this. Like, ultimately, narcissism is alienating because it's just very self-serving, and you can't be self-serving and then also have a real relationship that's going to go anywhere. And so they eventually get lonely or sort of feel sort of empty in a way. And once they feel loneliness or emptiness strongly enough, they're ready for change. They're ready to understand, how can I fix this?
So maybe somebody could take chances in revealing themselves little by little, you know, like Albert Ellis cognitive therapy. He would do those in vivo experiments where he'd send people out to face their fears and say, I just got out of a mental institution. What month is it? As we described in a previous show, he sent people out to do that at Rockefeller Center, which I love. But so maybe people, a kind of in vivo experiment would be that they could reveal something, go to a party and reveal three embarrassing things, you know, to see that vulnerability isn't so wounding.
Right. Yeah, that's great, actually, sort of learning to tolerate that.
And so now I want to talk about the dilemma of monogamy. And you talk about choosing between security and passion, which, of course, is a big thing for a lot of people. And there's this great chapter on that. And I want you to describe the characters in it. First, there's Alex. Who is Alex?
Okay, so Alex is sort of just a responsible, he's a New York guy, responsible, sort of sophisticated, intellectual, but this very sort of organized, contained, you know, person who sort of likes predictability and routine.
And then now Kasia was his girlfriend. She's originally from Brazil. And you start out this chapter, this is like the hottest scene in the book, with this bodice-ripping sex scene with the Russian, who is this other guy.
Yeah, so she comes in, and she's having an affair, and she wants to tell me about it, but she tells me, you know, in sort of grand detail about this very sexy experience to illustrate to me why she's bored having sex with her predictable boyfriend and, you know, to sort of justify why she should be having this sort of adventurous, you know, sex, and that, you know, she's not ready to live without passion. She's too young.
And now Alex, on the other hand, he made her out to be what you call an asexual granny pants. They dated for 3 years, and he had started to worry that this woman who just had this torrid clothing-ripping affair sex thing with this Russian, that she was sex-averse.
Right. So at home, you know, she's in her T-shirt. She's the kind of, you know, she's in her T-shirts and her retainer, sort of just falling asleep early, and, you know, she's not seductive with him at all. And that's how she presents to him.
Now, here's a question for you. Do you think that women make a mistake by letting themselves go? Because you talk about this throughout the book about how you say that, oh, it's really not a body type men are attracted to, but don't women need to be really careful to continue to keep up their appearance, to keep men attracted?
Yes, and I don't think that it's necessarily just a physical appearance. Even more important than physical appearance is keeping up a sense of eroticism. And being able to sexualize yourself in your environment and the person that you're with. And I recognize that's not possible all the time. You know, there are nights that you want, you know, you're tired. You want to be in your jammy pants. You want to, you have PMS. You just want to watch TV. You know, you're not interested in behaving sexy. It's not realistic. You can do it all the time. But as a general, like, value in your life to incorporate eroticism into your lifestyle is important. And that's one of the reasons I don't believe in that dichotomy of, you know, it's a trade-off. You either have security or you have passion, but you can't have both of them.
Right. Yeah, you talk about this, and you actually, you say that actually that the whole thing that researchers found, you know, the marital therapy strategies designed to increase your emotional intimacy were correlated with a decline in sexual desire. So there is a huge problem in this. How do you have a lovely, wonderful, warm relationship and keep up your eroticism?
Right. So I think that there's a few things going on. I think that what some of the marital therapy that they're talking about doesn't incorporate is sort of how to introduce into your relationship novelty, mystery, danger, things like that, things that are clearly associated in research with passion. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. You could hear me. Ready to, oh, no, the novelty thing, that is really important. And actually, you just reminded me of something that you wrote, and I think that this is so interesting, and I wanted to talk about it. It's that people commonly believe low libido in women is caused by some trauma. They were abused as children. But you call it a lack of sexual development. And yeah. You think that women like this woman, Kasia, and we didn't really tell her backstory, but we can get to it, that she, women like her, they internalize the ideals of their lovers, and instead of being who they are and doing what they want sexually, they try to be appealing.
Yes, and so she knows how to be sexy but not sexual. It's a, you know, it's sort of like she learned how to, like, go through all the motions to follow a sort of male sexual script, you know, like, I behave this way and I look like this. And so that got her attention, and that made her feel, that sort of, you know, was, you know, an ego issue for her. She felt validated and desirable and beautiful. And so she got, like, a little bit of a rush off of that, and that would fuel some sense of sexual desire for her. But that's not sustaining. Like, if you're wanting to have passion in a long-term relationship, then you've got to be intrinsically motivated. You have to find your own wellspring of inspiration, because eventually it gets tiring. You just get tired and bored of playing a role for somebody else.
Yeah, you have this great line here, because performing is exhausting and eventually you want to relax and be yourself. I have to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. My guest is sex therapist Dr. Brandi Engler, taking us inside the erotic minds of men. Her book, co-authored with New York Times bestselling biographer David Renson, is The Men on My Couch, True Stories of Sex, Love, and Psychotherapy. Stick with us and hear her fascinating stories and insights into why men have sex, what gets in the way, and what men and women can do about it. So, the thing, performing is exhausting, and eventually you want to relax and be yourself. How do you, because all these people you write about in the book, so many of them are lost. They don't know what their sexual selves are. They don't know what they really want. How would someone like Kasha figure that out?
It's a little bit of a process, but some of it is by literally just starting to ask yourself. I think the best thing to do is not to look to follow anything else that you see outside of you, but start in the moment. Like, what do I feel right now in this moment? And then sexualize that. So say, for example, you are tired and grouchy and even kind of PMS-y. If you try and go play, role play some role where you're supposed to be something else, then you're sort of putting on a mask and trying to force something that isn't real. But it's better to just sexualize exactly where you are, whatever that is, And so you can be creative with that. You can develop any kind of story or like erotic thing out of even a bad mood if you want to. But there's more energy in being authentic. And so it's important that women learn how to bring energy to the bedroom. Women who are most successful sexually prime themselves before they get to the bedroom. They start a process of sexualizing themselves and their partner before they even walk into the room, and it builds an energy so that sex ends up being an exchange of energy rather than one person, the man, having all the energy and the woman laying there like a dead animal.
Oh, that's really sexy and very exciting for the man. And you actually say men are often painfully aware when women are not authentically engaged. And you said Alex called sex with Kasha during that year that you had seen them soulless, which is really a horrible thing to say and a worse thing to experience.
Yes. Men know when you're laying there, thinking about what you're going to cook for dinner later or what you're going to wear tomorrow, and you're just sort of, come on, get it over with. They know, they feel the absence of her there, and it's painful for them. And then I'm always confronting them, then why are you even accepting this kind of sex? Why are you accepting that from her, but yeah, they feel rejected by it. They feel like when women aren't showing up.
And actually, I would think that this sort of thing, this sort of appeal to men, but, don't really need to have a personality, extends not just, it isn't just a bedroom thing. You write about that scene in Runaway Bride where Julia Roberts' character realized that she always ordered her eggs the way the guy she's with likes them.
Right. And so it's this process of getting women to turn inward and to ask and to start valuing, okay, what do I want? What do I need? What do I feel? And by starting to do that, her own natural creativity will come forth and her own natural sort of inspiration will come forth.
And now these two, she wanted to stay with this guy, Alex, but she said she honestly wasn't that attracted to him. She realized he was a good man. Do you think that that's okay to do?
I think that, no, not necessarily. I think a lot of women think they need to make that trade-off. Well, he's good. He's loyal. I may not be that attracted to him, and I'll just settle for that. But I believe it's possible to sexualize just about anybody, and it's a skill. One can learn sort of how to do that. It's just a little bit of a matter of a shift in perception to kind of learn how to do that, and, that way that you're not signing up for sort of a bland sex life for the rest of your life. People can have passion.
Okay, here's the pop quiz. Danny DeVito, okay. Sexualized Danny DeVito.
Okay, so you just, to him, it's like this sort of hot little guy, this hot little bald guy who, you're going to turn him, it's sort of, you just make it like he's, like a dirty thing, like it's sort of like sort of ugly hot in a way.
Okay. Okay. You proved it. I told you there would be no pop quizzes. I lied. We actually caller Hugh. He wants to talk about women who use their sexuality to manipulate men, not for love, is what Greg says. Greg, can you put him on? And Hugh, try to keep your questions short because we have a lot to get through. Hello, Hugh.
Yeah.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. I never met this woman in person, but came across her actually on a radio show and actually felt like a twin flame connection. And she, we mirror each other unbelievably. I think we have a telepathic connection, too. And over time, she became deceptive and manipulative and then threatening in a paranormal way. And I know that she's reinventing herself, and she fills the bill of a full-blown narcissist. I have her all boxed in, but I know some of her circumstances, and she had had sexual abuse by an older brother in her childhood. I send her light and love constantly, but what do you do with people like that?
Brandy, do you have an answer for him?
Of what to do with people like that? Well, that doesn't sound like that's working. That's going to work for you. You know, if you feel like somebody's intentionally manipulating or using, yes, many women do that, and that can be erotic to them for a brief period of time. But usually, you know, in any kind of real relationship, that's obviously not gonna work. Be a fulfilling relationship. But women who've been sexual abuse in their past do tend to exhibit a lot of various behaviors around sex that objectify sex, or they try to empower themselves by sort of behaving in ways that are harmful to the male, in a way.
What do you mean by objectifying? Can you just, when you say objectify sex, the women who have been abused objectify sex, what does that mean?
Well, they're angry, and so deep down they're angry because the sexual abuse has taught them that sex is meaningless, it's not special, it's not sacred, and neither are they, and neither is their body. And so they're angry about that. They try and sort of turn it around to a position of power to say, okay, well, if my body and sex are meaningless, then I'm going to use it to harm you. I'm going to use it to steal from you, to get money, to get whatever they want, whatever they want. And then they sort of feel gratified by that. They're just trying to sort of turn it around.
Yeah, I think there's a point at which that people need to look at relationships and say diminishing returns. And there's something we've talked about in the show before called the sunk cost fallacy, where people base their decision to continue on something on what they've invested in the past rather than what they'll get out. And that definitely sounds like one of those situations. But I want to move on to sexual mismatch, but I first should do a station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in therapy and research. My guest tonight is a fascinating sex therapist, Dr. Brandy Engler, sorry about that, spilling her secrets, taking us inside the erotic minds of men. Her book, co-authored with New York Times bestselling biographer David Renson, is The Men on My Couch, True Stories of Sex, Love, and Psychotherapy. So we're going to hear more about why men have sex, what gets in the way, and what men and women can do about it. And this is a huge problem for people, sexual mismatch. And Kasha and Alex had this. He wanted sex every night, and she would have been happy with it about once a week. What do you advise in a situation like that?
Oh, that's interesting. We see this quite a bit. Often just sort of meeting, but usually couples need to talk about it and kind of come up with some negotiation that sort of meets in the middle a little bit. But usually when I explore that, there's something going on with both the person who wants a lot of sex, and usually this is the male. Often a really high sex drive in a male is not about sex. And often it's being driven by some kind of emotional neediness, which women can sense and pick up on, and it's a turnoff for them. So then they start wanting sex less.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating because people like to make this really simple. And this is what I said when I said this is not the stuff you expect. See, you're coming through again and again. That's really interesting. And so what you seem to do over and over in these sessions with these people is draw out of them. They keep thinking it's just sex, and they even say that, but that – you know, really these men, you know, they want love and they feel vulnerable. And this is this thing where these people who have such, where women especially who look at men who are so negative about men, oh, he looks at porn or this and that, that I see throughout your book a compassion for the clients, even for the guy who bored you.
Right.
So, and that guy, that's actually, I want to ask you about that because that's got to be a hellish thing. You know, people don't think about this. What's it like for the therapist? You had this client who actually, you confessed that his sessions with you were boring. And,
right.
I mean, that must be really hard when you lose interest in a client.
I try to use it to help them because whatever personal reaction I'm having to the client, probably other people in the world are having that reaction to them as well. And, if they're in my office to improve their relations with women, then I just continually use my feedback of, like, the experience I'm having of him, even if it's something difficult. Like, I have to say that I feel a little bit bored. And I don't say it typically in that language unless there's enough of a relationship between the two of us where I know he can receive that from me.
Right. And now with that
otherwise
guy,
I might soften it.
With that guy, your mom told you to approach your patients when you called her and confessed that you were bored with this guy. Approach your patients with compassion was her advice, and you thought that sounded like a spiritual ideal, but then this guy said, you know, in your group therapy session, women are bitches. And this seemed to give rise to some compassion in you.
Yes. Well, first of all, about the compassion thing, you know, we don't all walk around feeling compassion. It's not that easily accessible all the time. As a therapist, you want to have that. It's some kind of, like, ideal, both spiritually and sort of professionally as a psychologist. And it's kind of hard for me to admit that I don't necessarily feel that naturally, particularly with some of these guys whose behavior to me is kind of repugnant. But what I sort of learned over time was that developing compassion is a bit of a skill, and I learned sort of how to develop it. And also the more that these guys were open and honest and vulnerable with me, the easier and easier it was for me to connect to them. Because when you look at what's underneath, some drive to connect, you know, misconnections and their sadness and their hurt, I recognize that in myself. Or, you know, it's like at the core, these guys are just like us. And there was something there for me to connect to.
And this guy actually, so sad, you said he associated love with humiliation and rejection based on his early experiences, and then he compensated by sexually denigrating women and controlling them in an attempt to manage these emotions. So it's like what you were saying before, you know, with the guy who wants sex all the time and often the women who only wants it once a week, that she's sensing that it's not really about sex, it's about weakness. And in this, you know, I mean, that's really sad, this guy. And it's not just, you know, it's easy to look at him saying women love bitches and think, what a despicable man. Take that look beneath.
Right. Well, it's, you know what, this is really important. I'm glad that you brought this up because this is not uncommon. There's a lot of men express this sentiment and this kind of anger. And I was glad that he was, you know, willing to sort of talk about this in a group. And just all the other men were sort of jumping on it, and the anger in the room was rising amongst them, just this collective rage, like, towards women. And so one thing that I realized is, like, to go into a man's shoes, when they experience these needs for us as women, for everything from their sexual impulses to their needs for love and affection, and they often, you know, because they often feel like they need to approach us, it's difficult because they set themselves up for rejection, right? And so in their fear of rejection, they often experience their own needs for us as humiliating or as embarrassing. And over time, that transforms itself into an anger, particularly if they're rejected often. And it's important that we understand the root of this anger because it's at the core of a lot of sexual harm that is out there. You know, these kind of sentiments that he expressed, you know, more innocuously. But when we look at the deeper sexual harms, you know, that are out there, this sentiment is at the core of it.
When you say sexual harms, what do you mean?
Anything, rape, you know, abuse, you know, things like that.
And you say under that when men who call women whore, or bitch, or crazy, that, you know, there's this deep wish for romance under that, you know, and the shame that's underneath that, that men feel, projecting the shame back at the women. If a woman encounters a guy like that, should she just run, or is there something she can do?
I wouldn't try and take that into my own hands to think that I can that I can fix something like that. I always believe in you know, treating people with, you know, kindness and compassion, but I wouldn't want to be in a relationship with somebody who's sort of stuck in that. It's hard. They often don't have insight into it because they keep telling themselves the narrative over and over that women are bitches or women are, you know, rejecting or women are controlling. She doesn't want to have sex with me because she's controlling or they want to control everything. As long as men are sort of telling themselves that narrative, it feels powerful to them. It's hard to get them out of it.
Yeah, I think that people have a hard time walking away. There are women who think that, oh, I can, you know, change him and transform him. Men think that too. And I get a lot of these guys writing to me, the shame-filled guys, and it is really some deep stuff. And really, I think that women have to be very careful about getting involved with those people.
Right.
I want to move on to porn because this is such a big issue for women. And you write about this guy, Casey, who described himself as madly in love with Amy, not me, Amy, a woman he described, definitely not me, as an Upper East Side sophisticate. This is, Upper East Side is a sort of wealthy, waspy side of New York. She had a regal air, but it turned out this guy spent much of his free time looking at porn on his computer, and he preferred women who were in some way disheveled, hair tangled, makeup smeared, covered in sweat or semen. So tell us about Casey.
Okay, so... Well, Casey, it's interesting. So, and Casey, I'm looking at particularly, okay, not porn, is it good, is it bad, what is it doing, but I'm looking at what's his unique relationship with porn. What part of himself is he trying to act out? What is he expressing through porn? So he's got this sort of, like, angelic, you know, like, woman here, and it's not your classic, like, Madonna whore complex thing that's going on. He's in love. He's, like, having this romantic thing going on. And like women, men can lose themselves in a relationship, like once they fall in love. It's hard, when you experience the power of falling in love with somebody, you want to please them, and it becomes sometimes for people hard to sort of be authentic, like sexually, to sort of, you know, ask for what you want and share fantasies and tastes and things like that. Instead, people sometimes fall into sort of vanilla routines that just go through motions because they're too sort of tepid about asking for things. And so guys who do that, like Casey, start splitting off, you know, parts of themselves into some other compartment where they, like a little secret place where they get to, like, act out everything that they're too scared and ashamed to act out with her. And sometimes that can start to become more and more extreme, both because of their own repression, that's what's causing the extremity of it, and because porn itself is set up so that, you know, you habituate to sort of like one level of bizarreness, and then you keep needing more and more novelty and bizarreness in order for your body to keep responding.
And now you actually say some really interesting things about porn. We'll get back to Casey. I should do a little station ID first, though. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Breast Brains and Therapy and Research. That's the best brains and some of the brains with breasts. My guest is sex therapist Dr. Brandi Engler, taking us inside the erotic minds of men. Her book, co-authored with New York Times bestselling biographer David Renson, is The Men on My Couch, True Stories of Sex, Love, and Psychotherapy. So you said some really, really interesting, compelling things about porn. You said porn does not reveal some irredeemable truth about men. Tell us what you mean by that.
That, you know, women can't look at the content of what's out there in porn and think, this is what men want. That this is like some truth about men's sexual behavior.
Okay. And so, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. So the porn, what does porn tell, what should porn tell women? What should women see from porn if they find out what the guy watches like this girl did in this case?
Right. I mean, I want women to look at porn just for what it is. I mean, it's like, it's a business, and, you know, in order to attract customers, they're going to design, you know, like scenarios that appeal to people's sort of basest emotions to really draw them in, you know, by sort of appealing to, you know, anger or, you know, fear, things like that. And then adding on, like I said, new levels of sort of bizarreness to sort of, you know, draw them in. And I don't want women to look at that and either think that, okay, this is what he wants, well, then I give up on men because this is, you know, despicable and I'm not doing this, or this is terrible or bad. And I also don't want women to look at that and go, okay, I need to act just like that so that men will want me.
And actually, you said this really great thing that I think will reassure women, that people are wired to respond to images of all kinds. So this is biology. It's not a big deal. You know, these are just somebody realized this would make the cash register ring if they showed, you know, the guy and the goat or the whatever. And yes. So they put that on the Internet, and people look because it rings their bell. But their biological
right.
bell, it doesn't mean they don't love you.
Women, when women are showed porn in research, they'll say at the outset of the research, I don't approve of this, and I don't like any of it, and their bodies respond equally to men's, if not more so.
Yeah, I love that.
Porn.
You referenced that great study with the pliz. I can never say it.
It
put a monitor on your genitals. And women are turned on by, like, bonobos. Women are turned on by lamps, practically. And men are only turned on, it's like if they're heterosexual. I think it's that they only like heterosexual men, and then some people say they're heterosexual and that they're not, and that shows up. But that women had the widest range of things they could be turned on by.
Yes, I actually look at that, you know, as a reflection of, like, our capacity, our sexual potential, you know.
Yeah, I like your positive outlook on that. No, but if women can understand, if they can divest, you know, some of the shame and upset they feel and the stuff where they say, you know, oh, he doesn't love me, and we should get into this about this girl. So this guy, because I want to backtrack a little bit, Casey loved Amy, who is a sort of, you know, a sophisticated China doll type girl, very beautiful. And the guy, he complained that she just wanted vanilla sex. You know, and that, actually, that wasn't the thing I wanted to say. It was that he was raised, I forgot this, he was raised by a feminist mother, and he felt uncomfortable objectifying women, and you noted that his urges really conflicted with his self-image, which caused
right.
him problems.
Right, right. So he felt guilty about what he was looking at, what he was getting turned on by.
And he sought out the sexual release in porn rather than his relationship. And was afraid to share with this China doll, sophisticated China doll, what he was into, like aggression and domination, you know, and the lack of feeling that was involved, because this went against everything he believed and who he thought he was.
Right. And who she was. And so he was afraid to sort of, he knew what she wanted, and he was afraid to, you know, for sex to have any other tone except for exactly what she wanted.
And you note, and see, that's bad. That's like the other side of inauthentic. And you note that porn is safe because there's no rejection. You know, the person on the screen on your computer is not going to be horrified that you're watching them. They're not even going to know.
Right. They're going to do whatever you want. You know, they're going to, you can, you know, have all of, you know, all of your tastes and preferences met with no judgment. It's a great bypass of anxiety, you know, of, But people, you know, by bypassing the anxiety that way, you also bypass an opportunity for growth. And the point of growth is that when you're in a relationship with somebody and you're afraid to ask for what you want, you've got to challenge yourself to start asking for what you want, push through that anxiety so that you can become, like, authentic. And then you would have people have hotter sex when they learn how to do that. Those couples out there that some people talk about who've been married for a long time are still having hot sex, that's their secret.
Repeat their secret so everybody can hear that again.
That secret is that they're not afraid to be themselves sexually. They're not hung up about rejection, or they're not judging, you know, each other on tastes and preferences. They're very open and exploratory, and they're not afraid to ask for what they want. And so they become very creative, and they push their levels of sort of comfort with each other, and they end up being more present as a result. And the more present people are, the more passion and excitement that they feel.
And I see this as, go ahead. I don't mean to stop you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, a lot of married couples just kind of, like, lay in bed, and they sort of, like, mechanically touch each other while both lost in fantasy in their own minds. They're not really present with each other. And that's fine. They'll have orgasms. They'll function. But they're not going to be excited about it. They're not going to experience passion, and they're, you know, not going to be super driven to, like, just repeating that.
And this is the thing that I see throughout your book, that you talk about authenticity. These people, many of these problems are caused by people's lack of authenticity, their fear of getting in touch with what they really want, not knowing what they really want, and not feeling comfortable expressing it to their partner, as you were saying.
Yes, exactly.
And so now this, you talk about how the essence of, you know, one of the big things in sex therapy is the homework. And so you give some homework, and Casey's supposed to share, you know, what he's into with Amy. And he does that, and it doesn't kind of go very well because you said that he didn't quite do it right. You know, he shares his non-vanilla desires, but instead of sort of explaining to them, he just imposed them on her, and she freaked out and assumed he didn't love her, and, you know, she's being betrayed. You know, she's just comfortable in that safe zone of making love. So talk a little bit about that.
So I wanted to show how, like, this thing that I'm saying, you know, just communicate, you know, be assertive and communicate. It's not exactly that easy, you know. It is challenging, so I wanted to show it's a common reaction that somebody's going to have, particularly if he's, like, not sort of communicating right. But, and then it also sort of brought to the fore, like, what she's doing with sex, which is she's narrowing the sexual experience to, like, one particular theme, which is sort of, like, this making love, you know, expression of love. And in doing so, she sort of stifled any sort of, like, creativity between the two of them.
Yeah, and she had this idea that love is only... She thought of sex as sacred, as this validation she was loved, and you actually, in the sort of post-homework session, reminded her that Casey actually loved her and respected her no matter what he wanted in bed.
Right, well, and that his sharing with her was itself an act of intimacy, itself an act of love, that because he was being vulnerable, he was taking the risk to be vulnerable to say, okay, this turns me on, let's try this or let's try that. And what does she do in his moment of openness? She shuts him down. And so her rigidity, you know, showed me what her anxiety was, basically, which is if sex doesn't have a loving tone, then that means something bad is happening.
And
that
I love
not love. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No, I didn't mean to stop you.
Just that she's afraid, you know, afraid that meant that she wasn't loved. That she, you know, a lot of women fear being used or being a sex object or, you know, that kind of thing.
And I love, you know, I think this is an interesting thing. She went on his computer and looked at the porn sites he looked at, and she had a few reactions. She started laughing. She got aroused, and she was repulsed and amused by the ridiculousness of these, you know, like semen-covered, sweat-covered women, you know. And so, you know, I think often if people actually, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong about this, if they have something that's in the dark, it's scarier. And if they actually, if women looked at these sites and they actually got to see what the guys are into, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, given that 95%, I think, is the stat of porn that's out there, does feature some element of either, you know, intentional sort of like humiliation or degradation toward the females, then it may just be hard for women to look at that particular kind of porn. Although there's tons of like alternative porn out there, you know, that isn't like that.
Yeah.
But I think exposure for women to like erotica, other porn, there's porn out there that's made by women for women, things like that. It actually can, you know, help to inspire.
And actually, I forgot to touch on this with Alex and Kasha. You had this great advice. You know, he had bought all these self-help books on how to please Kasha, but you actually gave him a book of poetry, Pablo Neruda's Captain's Verses, and this is poetry inspired by his wife, this animalistic and unrelenting desire for his wife, you know, so he could see maybe how to find that in his own life, and I think that's a really good idea.
Yes, I felt like I needed to give him some kind of model, you know, for the men who are out there who are having trouble connecting to their lust, their sort of carnal nature, and sex inherently, like, is it, like a physically aggressive act, like the act of penetration is physically aggressive, and a lot of men have all kinds of conflicts around acting on those aggressive impulses, like they get ambivalent emotionally about doing that, and so Pablo Neruda is this amazing poet who writes this sort of, you know, very erotic poetry that's aggressive. Like, he celebrates his lustful and sort of aggressive animalistic impulses toward his wife. And I think it's good. It helps men sort of connect to their sort of, like, internal, like, phallicness, if you will.
Yeah, we need help doing that. I think that the French are, and certain Latin countries, are very good about being sort of earthy and sort of close to nature. And we have this very process society, and I think that that's a really helpful thing. So Pablo Neruda's Captain's Verses. And you also asked Alex this very interesting question, how he seduced Kasia outside the bedroom. So how important is that, and how should men do that?
Oh, seducing outside the bedroom?
Yes.
So it's super important, and, you know, a lot of people think, you know, sometimes men will think, you know, like, that sex starts, like, once you get into the bed and, like, he reaches his hand over and, like, grabs at her crotch or something, and they're like, that's supposed to turn her on. Like, instead of recognizing that there's sort of an entire process, and it goes back to that thing I was saying about leading an erotic lifestyle. And so, you know, some of that, it could be anything, like, for any person. It could be anything from reading some Pablo Neruda poetry to, like, what Alex did, which was buy her a sexy black dress. He bought her lingerie. He had her meet him at a fancy hotel. So there's an element of mystery there. There's an element of surprise. You know, he's sort of courting her, allowing her to be beautiful. You know, so that's all outside the bedroom.
Yeah, I think that that's really important, and that men need to realize that, you know, that you cannot just get in there and grab her crotch. I had a question. Oh, I know. I'm sorry. It was that how does somebody – so once your relationship has gotten kind of tepid, how does someone resexualize a relationship?
I think it starts just with a shift in perception. So sometimes I'll have clients just do visualization exercises where they start to do that. And I always like to have people start from just what is true. So if you're like a married couple and you live together, like ask them to start, what is sexy about the kitchen? You know, think about like the eroticism of food. Think about, having music, sort of dancing a little bit, or creating a certain atmosphere, or just what it feels like to be in your bare feet. Like, there's all these sort of things that people can do to sexualize the immediate experience, because we treat our bodies like very utilitarian, like my body is to complete this and that task, or we're up in our head, you know, being very cerebral. But actually, like, we're sensual organisms. Like, we can, you know, just sort of get back into our senses to get yourself into that state.
Here's actually a question from Jim P. in our chat room. But what when she rejects the attempt to rub her back? You know you're in trouble, he says. Doesn't that reflect something deeper going on if a woman rejects a back rub?
Yes. All that should be looked at as communication. She's communicating something. So the right thing to do is to sort of gently explore, like, what's going on there.
Yeah, and I'm a big proponent of people talking, not in the moment of conflict, but, you know, taking a chill pill and waiting and saying, hey, can we talk about that, not in the moment when they're all upset, because I think it's too hard for people to be calm and mature. Certainly, I have issues being calm and mature, you know, in that moment of the heated conflict.
Right, so do I. You do.
Yeah, this is what I love about your book, because you're very humble and you talk about, you know, this throughout. We didn't touch on it too much, but this relationship you were having with this guy, you know, who had lied to you up front. And what I liked about you was that you had these great, you know, you had this line you drew, both with Rami, the guy that who was the main guy, and then with this other guy, Steve, who had lied about having a wife. And so you dumped him because you really seem to really, like, betrayal, no way, goodbye. That seems to be
right.
Your approach. And I think that's very wise.
Yes. Well, I think it took me, it took me some time with Rami to get there.
But it often does. I mean, the things here, all these chapters in the book seem to be processes with the men, and you seem to go through a process yourself, you know, with Rami more so than Steve. But just where you would sort of, it was interlaced with your sessions. How did your sessions affect your relationship? Were they positively, negatively, and how?
Both. Initially, it was negatively. I think it made me sort of hyper vigilant to, what is he doing? You know, because it was a long distance relationship, and he was sort of a womanizer. So my you know, imagination was all over the place, you know, about the various women he was sort of interacting with. So it made me more anxious. But over time, as I, you know, as I learned, then I became more sort of understanding and calm, and you know, then my relationship, including my relationship now, you know, much better. It's like because I've matured through the process.
Yeah, I think it's really important to see these bad relationships when you've had a relationship that doesn't work out or that ends badly or that the middle is bad, you know, that you see it as a learning experience and you don't just repeat your mistakes. And by being authentic and honest, that seems the best way to do that. And you, you know, are very honest about your shortcomings in the book and your own relationship and the way you see things and what you let go on. I mean, not that you were some kind of abused woman, but just that you wanted to, it seemed like you were very intent, as we all are, in finding love and wanting to, you know, see this as something that was going to work.
Yeah, I think that I, if anything, I developed a more realistic perspective on what love actually is. So that question presented in the very beginning of the book by David, am I capable of love, led to an exploration that weaves throughout the book about, well, what is love exactly? As each person in the book struggled with that question in his or her own way. And, you know, toward the end, through my work with the patients, like, I had to actually learn how to love them, each of them, in some way in order to be truly helpful to them. And as I learned how to sort of love them better from a humanitarian place, then I learned how to, you know, to love better myself.
And one of the things that you go throughout the book saying is that you see that these guys with all these problems, like the guy, we didn't get to him, the guy who had performance anxiety, couldn't get it up with his wife, Claire, or having sex with prostitutes, you know, that all these guys, you know, they want love. I mean, that's the bottom line. It sounds kind of sappy, but it seems to be the thing. You read, actually, you had a, your office was in the building with a massage parlor, and you said, I love your take on what massage parlor men you should read. Special number one, feel important. Special number two, feel powerful. Special number three, get nurturing and soothing. So, I mean, is that something that you see consistent in all of these people, or is it something else sometimes?
Yes, it's consistent. And I'll also mention that during this period of time, while I have these clients in my private practice, I live next door to a massage parlor that provided sexual services to men. And so on a daily basis, I'm walking in and out of my apartment, sort of watching all kinds of men from all walks of life go in and out of that parlor. And so sort of just contemplating for myself, why are they going in there? What are they getting from that? What are they seeking? You know, and so I started getting answers because these guys are also coming to my practice. And so, you know, it wasn't my intention to sort of project my sort of, like, wishes and ideals about love and wanting everything to sort of be about love in some way onto my clients. In fact, I intentionally sort of, like, withdrew from that kind of conversation. But I found that they were the ones bringing it up, which was a little bit of a surprise to me.
Yeah, the self-knowledge it takes for them to do that, especially, you know, because so many of them were in the dark about what they really wanted. You know, behind the porn or the prostitutes, that's very fascinating. We're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you to leave us with parting words for both women and for men. So give us, what are your parting words for women as a sex
very
therapist?
Very simple, actually, like particularly like when it comes to men, but for both men and women, is rather than judging each other, and continuing to tell stories about each other, you know, women are bitches or men are pigs, that don't serve us to tell those stories. They only disconnect us. Is to instead always ask why, what's going on, to have an attitude of curiosity about it, to withhold personalizing that of someone else's behavior is an affront to you. Don't personalize. And I think that's what actually helped to a lot of my patients to grow, is that through me sort of only exploring, not judging, and just asking questions, that the more soft they became, the more open they became. And any woman can do that with a man in her life.
I think you're right.
Yeah, just ask instead of judging, getting outraged and angry. Just, okay, well, let's talk about, you know, what's going on. Let's understand it.
Yeah, that's very interesting because you say that as a sex therapist, and you said that at the beginning, that you had to remove your judgment to not hate these guys, not just be a woman and think viscerally, oh, what a pig, but to understand
right.
what was going on underneath. And I think that you brought that up before with compassion, that to look compassionately at these people and understand how hard it is, like you said with the guy who said women are bitches, that actually helped you see him compassionately, because that kind of reaction, that can only come from somebody in pain. He's not just a hateful jerk.
Right, exactly.
So, well, we are out of time. I really want to thank you. I want to mention the name of your book again. I've been talking with Dr. Brandi Engler, Taking Us Inside the Erotic Minds of Men. Her book, co-authored with New York Times bestselling biographer David Renson, which I highly recommend, is The Men on My Couch, True Stories of Sex, Love, and Psychotherapy. Brandi, thank you so much. It's just been a great show.
You're welcome. Thank you.